Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Stephen Saum, and it is my pleasure to introduce Lieutenant Commander Rourke Denver, author of Worth Dying For, A Navy SEAL's Call to a Nation. Rourke Denver spent over 10 years as a platoon commander and training leader with America's premier special operations force, the U.S. Navy SEALs. A decorated veteran, he led special forces missions in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America, and he was the officer in charge of Bravo Platoon of SEAL Team 3 in Iraq. His team conducted nearly 200 missions, including sniper operations, direct assaults, special reconnaissance, and ground patrols. For his service, Denver was awarded the Bronze Star with V for Valorous Action in Combat. After returning to the United States, Rourke Denver was appointed flag lieutenant to the commanding officer of Naval Special Warfare, traveling to Afghanistan and briefing Congress on SEAL operations. In 2009, he became first phase officer of SEAL basic training, including Hell Week. He was later promoted to basic training officer in charge of all phases of advanced sniper, hand-to-hand combat, diving, and communications instruction. At the request of the U.S. Navy, Rourke Denver starred in the 2012 film Act of Valor. He's an honored graduate of the United States Army Ranger School and was an All-American lacrosse player at Syracuse University. He recently served as a mentor on Fox's American Grit. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Rourke Denver. So, Rourke Denver, it's fabulous to have you back at the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you for having me.
Yep. Thanks for joining us. So, in Worth Dying For, you cover a range of calls to the nation, right? One of those is a call to service in a lot of different forms. And you actually have a specific policy proposal that you put forward there, and I'd like to kick things off with that. Can you talk about that, your call for national service?
Yeah. I mean, I think the call to serve militarily is one that I think hits each individual for a myriad of reasons. I think some people find it on their own and have this desire to go serve the nation in military service. I think, as I write, it's become a family business as well. The amount of people that have a long lineage of service or family members that have served is approaching 80% of current service members, which is pretty mind-boggling. So it's become almost a family business. My thought is that the experience I've had through service, how that shaped me as a person, the way I look at the world, the way I look at politics, the way I look at our culture, society, and the world at large has been very powerful. And so I think service is a vehicle to really help people grow and keep us invested in something that is hopefully a shared set of values. So I think there are a lot of countries that have compulsory military service. That's not what I'm advocating for, although that would be an option. But I think some level of required service would be a game changer for our country. And so I write it in such a way that service, you know, let's say we made an amendment and made this, you know, a constitutional requirement for people living in the United States of America. I see it as something that you would go through your schooling. Let's say you finish high school. If you're not going to college, you'd start your service then, 1 year of mandatory service. That could be military. It could be working with an NGO. It could be a government organization. It could be an aid organization. I'd like to see it happen on American soil. I'm not for isolationism, but I think the service should take place here. I think best served if you grew up in Dallas, your service should take place in the Northeast. Or if you grew up in California, maybe your service is in the Midwest. And so you'd get out of your comfort zone, live on a subsistence wage, and actually think of others before yourself. And then I think when you're done with that service, you can carry on to whatever adventure you want to get in next.
So why here on this soil? Why in the States and why not?
I still believe we are truly one of the guides of the world. We're the police of the world, and I hope we set an example that can be followed. And I think our system of government, our experience culturally and who we are I still fundamentally believe is something that most people would choose if they had the option to that freedom. I have no problem with service abroad, and I'm not for circling the wagons and not being out there in the world. I think the service here would be powerful because it would make you invested in what we enjoy and experience here. I mean, I've seen, you know, I watched something recently. Oprah's talking about these orphanages and things she's opened in Africa. That's wonderful. She's from Chicago. Like, there's a lot of work that could be done in Chicago that Oprah has the resources to get involved with. I'm not saying she's not. I'm sure she has programs the world over. But I do think service here would have, it'd just be more of a buy-in for what we enjoy here. So that's why I'd see it existing on our shores.
Well, you know, I was really struck by that when I read it because the year I graduated from college, Sam Nunn gave the commencement speech where I went to school, and he used that opportunity to call for a national service program. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, kind of interesting to kind of see, yep, see it come back around again. So at the end of your book, and this, I guess, is connected with some sense with service, because you talk about this kind of the sense of unity and bonding in this country that, you know, you hope that will reinforce. At the end of your book, you state, remember 9/11. I mean, everyone does. But that got me to thinking, and my son, who's now, he's now 15, so he was just barely alive then.
Yep.
The next time we have a presidential election, we'll actually have voters who, you know, who weren't born when 9/11 happened.
Sure.
So, you know, I guess I'm wondering, you know, so what do you look for as for a bonding moment or bonding principles with that question of service? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think the distance from when 9/11 unfolded to now is it still shocks me. I mean, I when I do speaking events kind of in the corporate world, I talk about where I was on 9/11. I usually ask the audience, you know, do you remember where you were? Of course, every hand goes up. I did that at a junior high recently, and they're all looking at me with, you know, glazed over. I was like, oh, that's right. You don't remember where you were on 9/11, which blows my mind that we've been in the fight that long.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say we could make 9/11 the galvanizing force, which it was for a very tangible period of time, I think, in the country and the way people saw who we were and how we related to the world and a purpose of defending what we hold dear. I think that's where the service would just have this potent ability to do that. I mean, I think one of the things that's very special about being in the military, and I'm not sure if people realize what a gift this is, and I don't think I realized it until later in my career, but when you join the military, you know, you show up at basic training and they shave your head, which I've stuck with, but they shave your head, they put you in a white t-shirt, same pants, same boots, and it doesn't matter where you're from. You could be, you know, a cowboy from West Texas, you could be a gangbanger from, you know, some rough part of the country. You could be a silver spoon elite level college graduate, and everybody goes in and is basically treated the same. And through that group usually comes together to kind of see things the same way and start really appreciating those things that the others experienced. You know, my last assault team, I had a kid that was a Rhodes Scholar on my team as one of my junior officers, and I had a kid that I am 100% positive that never graduated from anything, fudged that to get into the military, and is absolutely one of the most creative, intelligent, driven people I've ever met. And those two coming together and seeing them share experience is very, very special. So I think that's another part of the service, particularly for young folks. That's why I'd love to see it in that, you know, graduate high school. Maybe you can defer, go to college, and then you'd have to do it when you finish college. You don't get to get out of it. But to do that with these people from disparate backgrounds, different socioeconomic, cultural experiences, and go get in a struggle together, I think it would give an appreciation for what people have learned, who they are, what they believe in, and would help people see things in a very, very different light. And I think it'd be powerful moving forward with that experience.
Now for you, the call to service in the military, you write about how it came from reading Winston Churchill.
Yep.
Can kind of bring, some folks may have heard that before, but I think it's a cool story.
Yeah. So, I love to read. My dad loves to read. My brother loves to read, and we often share books with one another. So we read something we enjoy. We usually blast that back and forth. And my senior year of college, I'm playing lacrosse at Syracuse. I'm a fine arts major, so I have no potential whatsoever for success leaving Syracuse. And I don't know what I want to do next. And my dad sends me a paperback copy of Winston Churchill's My Early Life, which is an autobiography he wrote much later in life, but chronicles about his first 30 years. And a wonderful new book has just come out about one piece of that book when he was a prisoner of war in Africa, escaped, made his way back beyond enemy lines, skirmishes in Cuba, the frontier wars, and something about the quality of his writing, the quality of his thinking, and just this idea of kind of youthful adventure struck me very much. So I put that book down, and I remember calling my dad, and I said, I'm going into the military. And I don't think that was his intent on sending me the book. That being said, I don't think it surprised him either. I always like playing rough. I kind of like to fight and like to compete. And so it felt like a calling, and it felt like the right place to go. And so once I knew I wanted to serve, I started researching the different programs, and I heard about this Naval Commando program in Southern California where 80% of the people don't make it through, and that sounded like the right odds to me, and it was. It was a perfect place for me to land. It's a very unique combat organization compared to others, conventional forces, and even other special forces. The SEALs are different, and I don't say better, different. They just think in a creative way that we're not bound by doctrine and things that other units tend to constrain themselves with. So, you know, my guys were free. We're very informal. My guys called me by my nickname. I called them. We knew how to turn it on in front of Marines or in front of Army, so the leadership didn't think we were just complete cowboys. But we welcomed creative thought and new ideas. I mean, if you were in a Marine unit and you walked up and had some outlandish idea about how to get something done, there's a good chance you're going to be told to stay in your place and not do that. If one of my guys in San Diego came walking up and said, I just read an article in Popular Mechanics that says, you know, orangutans can sense explosives, we would go over to the San Diego Zoo and start teaching chimps to jump the next day. And that's fun. It's fun to be part of a group that kind of lets you do that. So it fit my personality, both discipline-wise and getting an adventure and with a very, very intense group of folks.
So you mentioned they call you by your nickname. What's your nickname?
Diesel. All right. Which I picked up in college playing lacrosse. I played here in the Bay Area. I grew up here. And Syracuse was a real titan on the lacrosse landscape at that point. And nobody had really gone from the West Coast to play out there. And I got razzed pretty good. I had long hair. I show up at Syracuse, and they're like, you know, this kid from California is not going to make it. And one senior in particular picked on me and just like twisted it in me. And at one point, he's running full speed down the field. I'm going the other direction, and he's getting a pass, and he's kind of doing this number. So he's not looking at me. And I put everything I have ever put into a hit into him. It broke his helmet. He went down, and my coach, who was nicknamed Slugger, who's a fighter, he came walking over to this senior and said, I guess picking on the California kid didn't work out. You look like you got hit by a diesel pickup truck. And that was it, and it stuck. And then my SEAL buddies heard it from one of my college buddies, and it stayed. So, yeah.
But you actually tell this story, though, about when one of your guys crossed the line in terms of informality. Yeah, can you tell that story?
Yeah, so you know that level of informality that I talk about it's nuanced, and I think our guys do a really good job with it. I don't know how that has maintained in a good way, and there's probably times when there's breaches in that. But one of the things we do at the SEAL teams is the enlisted and officers train very much the same way, and we train in the same environment. And there's very little. There's no quarter given the officers. And in fact, there's a pretty good argument to say through basic training, we get it worse because the guys are testing who their leadership's going to be. But when I made it to the assault teams, I'm running a team. So I'm in charge of this, 16 group of wild men. And we like to fight even when we're not fighting. So we started doing jiu-jitsu and a bunch of hand-to-hand fighting. So we created this little club in the morning where we'd get up even earlier than a regular military day, 4 in the morning, and we'd fight. We'd fight every morning. And a couple guys were master-level trainers in jiu-jitsu. And this guy that started with the same time as I did had been a high school All-American wrestler, and he just started to excel at a very, very quick rate compared to the other guys in the room. And I remember I beat him one morning. He beat me. We had a really good battle going. And we finished. We went back to the locker room. And I remember as we were getting cleaned up, he turned to me and said Rourke. He used my first name, which he'd never done. It was either nickname, LT, Mr. D would be about the most informal my guys would say. So he called me Rourke. And I remember saying to him, I said, you know, I want to share something with you when it comes to this. And he was one of my junior guys. One of my most junior guys. I said, when you call me Rourke, it doesn't bother me. Like, my ego is not going to feel good with you calling me sir or calling me commander or whatever that might be. It's actually a reflection of you. And it's a reflection of the discipline that goes along with the job we do. So when you say that, it makes me think you're not professional. You're not squared away. Even, again, we push the limits with the nicknames and things like that. But I said, you know, if you were to call me by my first name in front of a bunch of Marines or in front of another team, they are going to think we're idiots. They're going to think no discipline, no capacity for focus and drive. And so I told him as we move forward, you can't do that. On top of the fact, if our chief, you know, the senior enlisted guy, hears you call me by my first name, you're going to be duct taped and strung up a flagpole like the next afternoon to, like, you know, get that together. So it's a nuanced thing. So our guys are good at kind of towing that line. They'll use a nickname and know when to turn it on. And he just breached a level that I thought actually took credit away from him and his professionalism as opposed to my need to be called something formal.
So since the last time that we sat down to talk, women have played more of a role in combat. Yep. Can you talk about your opinion and concerns?
It's a slippery slope. Look, I have daughters. I have a bride that I'm crazy about, and I think the world is opening for women in ways that is just mind-boggling, and I think they're gonna take over. I think that's well on its way, which I'm good with my daughters coming into the world. I also think guys have no idea what it means to be a man anymore. I think young men are aimless and absolutely unaware of what it means to be a man. So I think that's a separate problem. As far as women in combat, we had women on our teams. I mean, not SEALs, so that the you know, Congress didn't allow women in main force combat units or aggressive forward-moving combat units. That's now been lifted, which happened under, I think, Panetta's watch. And then the only units that have been resistant or reserved to that have been some of the special forces units. The capacity for work on the battlefield, I have no issue with whatsoever. Learn to jump, shoot, communicate, fight, dive, do all those different things, 100% capable. You look at the top 50 women in the CrossFit Games, I don't know a guy other than the top 50 men in the CrossFit Games that are in better shape than them. I have no doubt they can get through training or you know, the best of them, just like guys. I mean, people think, can they, you know, only a small number of guys make it through our training. The reservation, it's a reservation, not an objection I have with women in our unit, is absolutely cultural, not performance and capacity for work. The person I am on the battlefield and with my guys at the SEAL team is a very different person than I am at home. The gentleman that I hope you spend time with tonight, that you'll see afterwards, that I talk to, the way I relate to my bride, the way I relate to, you know, women, men, everybody is very different than what is required of someone on the battlefield. And we encourage and kind of breed that in this very Spartan, violent, brutal culture at the team. My only reservation is, does that maintain in a co-ed locker room? Does that maintain in the same intensity and ferocity that it does with nothing but guys? You know, the Israelis have done some recent experiments where they realize, particularly with our current enemy, that Arabs and some of our enemies right now, when they see women in the combat units, double their intensity in fighting and are very excited about capturing that bounty on the battlefield. Now, again, any woman that comes into the unit, I'm sure, is prepared for that fight and prepared for that eventuality. I just think it is a slippery slope. We'll see. I mean, the other thing also is I'm a realist, and you put men and women together, and I think we all know what happens. The only two issues I ever had in leading my assault team were drugs and alcohol, which was going to ruin anyone, man or woman, and marital girlfriend problems. Those are the only things I ever had my guys not focus on the job at hand. If you told me my sniper pair, male and female, in the middle of a sniper mission are having some type of quarrel about the extracurricular activities they have off the battlefield, that would be a rugged afternoon to like manage that. I'm not saying it's going to happen. It's a huge challenge and not one that I have a great answer for. My recommendation was, awesome, let's run through SEAL training and have an all-female platoon. Let's just have an all-female assault team and go to work.
So since you mentioned a sniper team, actually, you wrote a piece a couple years ago after American Sniper came out. I think it was a response to criticism that the film was getting, and it was trying to set a larger context. Can you tell us about that? Tell the audience about that.
Yeah, my teammate Chris Kyle, who was killed in one of the most prolific snipers in the history of the U.S. military, highly decorated, true heavyweight on the battlefield. Came back from multiple deployments, took unhealthy veteran, mentally unstable veteran out shooting just to help him actually process some PTSD and some issues, and that veteran shot Chris in the back and killed him. And so when Chris was killed, his book became all the more popular. Clint Eastwood and Bradley Cooper made the film about American Sniper. When that movie came out, Michael Moore, Seth Rogen, a few other Hollywood elites started commenting very actively on social media about negative comments about Chris, about snipers, about them being cowards, and a lot of stuff that confused me when I saw what they wrote. And so I wrote an op-ed that got picked up by the Wall Street Journal called the United States of American Sniper. And my point of it was far less to, pump up Chris or beat them up, but it was more to say the funny reversal of what you're doing is, Michael Moore, when you beat Chris up and voice that opinion, you actually couldn't honor his death anymore because he is the person that has offered you that opportunity to say what you want to say. A soldier has paid for that price. Chris is one of the great ones. And you are exercising the very thing he fought for. So I feel like you're, watering the First Amendment by saying that. So you may have actually thrown yourself a curveball because I think you honor him in doing so. So I just had fun. I guess I had fun with them at their expense at a buddy of mine who had paid the ultimate price to guarantee those freedoms. And when you travel to the ugly parts of the world and the places that we fight, what we enjoy here, it's hard to wrap your head around. And I talk about in that article that freedom, this thing we enjoy here, which is so fragile and so, ever fleeting, that is our greatest weapon. I mean, a nuclear weapon, powerful. I hope we never see it deployed. I guarantee you fundamental, extremists are more afraid of freedom than they are our nuclear arsenal. Hands down, it would unwrap everything they hope to maintain if it was, inflicted upon them.
Well, and one of the things that gets talked about with Chris and that you write about in the book too is also the multiple deployments and the back and forth. Kind of coming back to what you were saying about, so you had drugs and alcohol on the one hand, and then you have marital girlfriend problems. When you're bouncing back and forth between multiple deployments, that seems like that's going to come with the territory.
There's a tremendous cost. I mean, I think some guys' families balance it well, and a lot don't. I think the maturity and kind of emotional maturity of SEALs, for the most part, they do well. I think for a large era pre 9/11, we had a tremendously, tremendously high divorce rate post Vietnam. Pre 9/11, I think our guys were just drinking beer, brawling guys that didn't have anybody to go fight. I think now that we're in the fight, our guys just want to go fight and get back to their families. And it's a different generation of SEAL. Our young guys, I think some of the older guys, most of whom have now moved on, were very puzzled by my generation of SEALs. A lot of guys still drink and party, but there's a whole group that doesn't or doesn't make that a huge part of their life. They want to train and climb and push themselves to another limit and kind of very much focus on these disciplines above and beyond, the college frat boy days. And I think it's a healthy thing for the environment. So most of my buddies have maintained phenomenal relationships, mostly based on the merit of outdoing themselves by marrying good gals. And that's that was my blessing a thousand times over. I went way, way above myself in finding my bride. And so she was tough enough to, you know, take that time and metabolize those deployments and that time away. She and I have had some intense conversations about my experience at war and what that's been like. And she's very, very open about the fact that she knew the price of dating me was that possibility. And I'm very happy that it, you know, so far we've made it work.
I remember one of the comments that you made last time was that, among SEALs, that the incidence of PTSD seemed to be lower than it was among a lot of other areas of in the service. But you'd expressed concern that you said the guys just seem better at metabolizing a lot of things, and maybe this is one of those areas as well. Have you seen an increase or that kind of a longer metabolizing?
I think unfortunately I'm right, or my hypothesis was right. I have some of my good friends and some folks that are top level performers that I thought would never have issue, and they're hitting some real rough roads. So I've got, you know, buddies that I thought were just pillars and would never break that have broken. And I write about in Worth Dying For that. I think there is a level, there is a threshold that might be different for every person of how much time you can spend immersed in ugliness and savagery and butchery and the things that, you know, we've seen on the battlefield. I think I stopped at about the right time. I sleep well at night. I have zero regrets. I don't feel any more aggressive than I was going into it. I'm pretty aggressive just anyway. But in general, I think that's in balance, and I feel good about it. I feel it's like a right level when it comes to that. I do have friends. I had a buddy from my last deployment who went to what's called Dev Group. It's, you know, now it's all over the news, SEAL Team 6, which is like our all-star team. And I have friends there that they aren't the same. I think they've just been going at it too long. I think guys that were funny just don't have the same sense of humor. And I think they've just been immersed in ugliness for too long. And I think there's only so much you can take of that. So I think we do have a much higher rate of PTSD or combat stress than is being advertised. I do think we also have systems in place and phenomenal professionals, because we have great funding lines to do what we need to do to take care of the guys to help with that. So, I mean, I think we're on it. The toughest thing is our guys just won't say anything. Our guys are tough, and they won't say they're hurting, and then they kind of crack.
And one of the things that you talk about, and certainly we keep seeing in the news with sort of, you know, new and disturbing angles on it, I guess, is the VA's inability to help veterans who are contemplating suicide or, you know, do end up committing suicide.
Yeah. 22 veterans a day is the statistic. 22 veterans a day are taking their lives. That's from, you know, the current war all the way back to any other war somebody fought in. So, I mean, that covers a larger spread than just the current fight, but it's a pretty staggering number when you start thinking about it. And, you know, the VA, I don't like beating people up. I mean, it's tough to do that, because I know there's tremendous, tremendous people working at the VA. If you told me tomorrow I had it, well, it's a very, very tough thing. I think the VA could be completely retooled, or some level, the bureaucratic level, the VA disbanded, the doctors, the facilities, all that stays and create a different system that runs it. I think it could be better run than the government. Well, I mean, we know this above and beyond the military. The government's slow. And the government is this grinding machine that doesn't respond to things very quickly. And so we're always time late on things that you just – those guys don't deserve, and gals don't deserve late on.
Well, I guess, even one of the fundamental simple things that came out this week was that up to 20% of the calls have been rolling over to people who are untrained, or even going over to voicemail at some facilities, because the staff weren't putting in enough time, or we're taking time off early.
Yeah, which seems like how could that be possible? I mean, how could that phone go to voicemail? Like you need to, that it can't be a difficult algorithm to work out, that this is the number of calls, this is the volume, that's when this peaks, and somebody needs to answer the phone. Yeah.
So one of the audience members here wants to know, how does one instill grit in a child? You write some about grit, so we can.
Yeah. I think we've created this very, very plush, cushy, soft world, right? I mean, I think everything we've designed, and there's a whole lot of good that goes along with this, is based on avoiding suffering and pain. And I feel like we've created systems within traditional experiences, like kids getting a race and only one kid getting a blue ribbon. And now everybody gets a blue ribbon for participating. And I know I'm not going to let that happen with my kid. It's already happened. You are going to think I'm a lunatic. But my daughter came back from field game. She said, I won a race today. I said, oh, I love it. Did you have fun? Did you give your best? That's great. She said, yep. You know, Rick and Will, they were in front of me. And then, you know, Clara and Kelly were behind me. I was like, wait. Who was in front of you? And she said, Will and, you know, this other kid. And I said, so you were in third? She said, yeah. I said, well, you didn't win the race, which is fine. I just want you to go as hard as can be. And believe me, you're gonna smoke Will at something else. But, like, if the teacher told you you won the race, that is not accurate. Like, I want you to give max effort. I want you to go hard as can be. But I don't think you're going to do any service to someone saying you won when you didn't win. I personally believe there's still merits to winning and losing and struggling and look, I learned more in my life from my losses and failures than I'm ever going to learn from my successes. You know, the games I remember from when I played at Syracuse were like the six games we lost. And I don't remember much from the games we won, but I remember everything from the games we lost. When I screwed up as a tactical commander, I remember every one of those. And I know I made, hopefully, more good decisions. I don't remember any of those. And so I think giving kids an opportunity to fail, letting them fail. You know, right now, if you're at a playground here in the Valley or anywhere USA, a kid's trying to zip their jacket. I mean, seven parents will swoop in to help them zip their jackets. Like, let them zip their jacket. How are they going to learn to zip a jacket? You know, let them work it out. And so I've had a couple parents look at me crazy when I'm letting my girls struggle, but they're going to get good with struggle, you know. And I struggled. I was not strong academically, particularly in math and science, up through high school. It took to about high school to get some testing that I actually had a learning disability. Consequently, I struggled and got used to struggling. So that, you know, whenever I hit a wall, I'd be like, well, here we go, put your head down and start going to work. And I think there's a lot of people that are being led to a place where they don't have to work. And so when they hit these wickets, sadly, much later in life, they really hit it hard. I was talking to a gal that does research over at Stanford, and she's noticing these kids are showing up to Stanford in these elite programs that have never failed, and then a professor there is like, by the way, that paragraph is horrible, and they're killing themselves. But a kid that grew up in Compton that got a scholarship to come up here, no problem. That kid's going to be indestructible because they've been grinding it out from day one. So I think you give your kids opportunities to struggle and fail, and it doesn't mean you want them to fail or you admonish them for failing. Much to the contrary, you say, okay, we fell short. How do we get better? How do we keep fighting, and how do we keep struggling on?
So speaking of grit, so you spent a little bit of time on a show called American Grit this past year. So what was your role on that? For those who haven't seen it.
Yeah, so American Grit was a reality show where 16 athletes, 8 men, 8 women, were competing, you know, for a cash prize if they made it to the end, through a bunch of military-esque challenges. John Cena, who's a WWE superstar and actually one of the great people I've ever met, just a very down-to-earth global superstar, he hosted it. And then they brought four military cadre, which is what we call instructors in the military. And so I ran a team of four, 2 guys, 2 gals, and 3 other ran the same, and we competed them against each other in kind of military-inspired challenges. And then if you didn't win the challenge, you had to put your team or one member of your team into something we called a circus, which was just some horrific two-failure event that we'd find out what people are made of, and we found out what people are made of. So it was a neat experience. We're approved for a second season. We'll see what happens, and hopefully we get to do it again. It was a lot of fun to be a part of.
Yeah. And it wasn't on kind of off on a tropical island somewhere.
No, we were in central Washington State. It was, I think, average of about 12 degrees out and snowing the entire time. It was miserable. I mean, the film crew was like, God, you guys must be miserable. I was like, this is my kind of weather. I mean, I'm built for cold weather. This is good living for me. I don't think it was fun for the cast, but I had a blast. Yeah.
So someone here in the audience wants to know, what was the most challenging part of Buds?
You know, BUDS, if someone doesn't know in the room what BUDS is, basic underwater demolition SEAL training is our training program. About 75 to 80% of the folks that show up don't make it. We don't get rid of that many people in SEAL training. Almost everybody quits on their own. They just, at some point in training, figure, I have never been this cold, wet, and miserable in my life. You guys are crazy, and I'm out of here. So they leave. I think the hardships are different for everyone. So the absolute standard is how cold you get. You go to training in Coronado Island, San Diego, so you think you're going to this idyllic beach town, and you are unaware that Pacific Current runs right through the coast of San Diego so that, you know, the water temperature is in the 50s most of the year. So you don't need to sit somebody in 50-degree water all that long to get them, you know, chattering to the point where they can't, you know, button their shirt, and that tends to wear on a lot of people. So I would say the cold sends most people home. And then sometimes people's bodies, just their, you know, their physiology doesn't hang tough. That's the toughest to see. You'll see a kid that is unbelievably strong mentally and spiritually and just doesn't have the body. That's brutal to watch, because you'll have some guy sitting next to him that looks like, you know, looks like a Greek god, and he's just kind of a wimp. And so you wish you could take the heart out of the kid that doesn't have the body, put it in that guy, and then you'd have the perfect being. But I used to say that to the students. I said, don't praise false idols. When you're sitting in a class like this, we'll sit and it'll start with this big number, and only 20, 30 guys are going to graduate. And I say, don't praise false idols. You're sitting next to a kid who looks like Michelangelo, chiseled him out of marble. He just told you his dad's a senator. He's a sub-Olympic swimmer. He can sprint like a gazelle. Like, and you're going to think this is the archetype, and he's going to hit that cold water tomorrow, and he's going to quit. And the kid on the other side of you has got a little bit of baby fat, grew up in like Bourbon Belt, Kentucky, has never seen an ocean, taught himself to swim about 2 weeks ago, and we will not be able to kill him with a nuclear weapon. So it's really a head-up program. And so if you want to see it through, you'll see it through. I think an interesting part about the training is the guys that are meant to get through it, they just kind of have fun there. I mean, I remember it being miserable, but I remember laughing more than anything else. And I knew I'd found the peer group I wanted to be around, and that place was made for me. And my body held up, which goes a long way. But the hardest thing for me at the BUDS was the dive physics exam, which involved math, and I thought I was going to get kicked out of the program for, like, arithmetic. Yeah.
So someone here in the audience wants to know about your advice on bridging the military-civilian divide, which is actually that's something that you write about at some length here. So I think we can kind of dive into that a bit.
Yeah. I don't know how much I offer up on how to do that. I just am kind of identifying this problem. I mean, I think we talked a little bit about earlier. I think there's two worlds that exist here in this country, and it's this less than 1% of the population which is serving in the U.S. military and everybody else, which is not to take away from everybody else being wrong for not serving. It just is, it has become this very small group of people that are shouldering the military burden for everyone else. And I think, again, it's become a family business. It's become this this thing. I mean, I can trace, you know, my dad's dad was killed in the Pacific Theater of War. You know, both my uncles served. I mean, a lot of people in our family have served over the years. And so there is this kind of, familial trend of people serving. So I think what, and then it also bridges over into our public service life. You know, for, I think I write in there, I think I'm right on the fact, even up until about 1971, 72% of the House and I think 78% of the Senate were former military. That's how many people had served in the military and now were in political service. And this most recent Congress that was voted in and stood up, we're down to 18%. 18% military service in the government, and even lower in the Senate. And so I don't think military service is a requirement, but that's a tremendous shift, a tectonic shift from the experience of military service and the sacrifices and the understanding of that world to our political elite and leadership having absolutely no connection whatsoever to that group of folks for which they set budgets, plans, and deploy us to war. So I just think it's two worlds that need to connect. And there are plenty of people that I think are unhappy with any SEAL, any special operator, anyone in the military writing a book. I don't begrudge them that belief. I also don't try and throw stones in a glass house. I wrote a book because I feel we have this treasure trove of information and cultural experience around the world with enemies that are every bit going to be part of the decisions we make as a country. And if we circle the wagons in the military and don't share that information, I don't see how our leaders could make good decisions on how to move forward. I mean, to be honest, dealing with ISIS is like a Dick and Jane book to SEALs and special operators. That isn't rocket science, how you can take care of that problem. But to those that have never seen it, never felt it, never smelt it, don't know what it is, then it is an enigma and hard to figure out. And so I think if those two worlds aren't talking, we're in big, big trouble. I am a constant optimist, but I think I'm also a realist, and I think we may be permanently at war in some capacity for well beyond the time I'm probably going to be alive in this country. So I think if that's the case, which I believe it's so, not maybe a massive engagement in Iraq, but some level of combat with disparate groups and non-state actors and probably state actors, I think it would be an egregious mistake not to have thinking, thoughtful warriors in that conversation. So that's kind of how I say that gap needs to be closed, or at least talking to one another. We're gonna miss a big piece of the puzzle.
And understanding what it means to be sending the troops into
for sure. Yeah, no, very few people are sent. And even the presidents. I mean, you look at the last, six, seven presidents. It's, their backgrounds are senator, governor, politician, lifetime politicians, which I do not think is good business. I think citizen service members that come in, send a period of time, then go back to what they're doing would be much more powerful than career politicians. There's an argument to be made, well, they know the system, and I'm not so sure.
Do you ever have people encourage you to think about running for office?
Yeah. I got other adventures to do first, but it's by no means off the table. I have loved my time in military service so much, and I don't think the country does well without hopefully the right people serving. So it's out there. I've got some other things I want to do first, but it's possible.
So here's a question. Someone here in the audience wants to know, what advice would you give a leader who is transitioning from operations to administration?
Stay in operations. My first commanding officer, who's still my favorite commanding officer of all time, told me that very same thing. He's like, he said, stay in operations. Once you get into the executive administrative level, all the fun gets sucked out of the game. But I think this is the thing I'll say about all leadership. I think a lot of leaders have lost the concept that the higher you go up the chain of command, the higher you go up the flagpole, the more people you are now in service to. If you understand that, the rest of it will fall into place. If you realize that you are in service to everyone below you in the chain of command, and I mean that, commit to that you are there to lift the burdens first, to earn their respect by sweating yourself, being there early, staying late, and doing that job. There's nothing else you need to know about leadership. If it's the opposite, if the further you go out in that C-suite in a leadership space, you think more people work for you, you're blowing it. And you might not know it, but your people definitely know it. So that's what I would say. I mean, if I was going from operations to administration, I did. I went from operations to the executive level, and I just tried to constantly think, what is the shooter, and what can I do for my guys? And if I went home early and didn't feel like I'd turned a stone over that needed to be there, I'd go back.
So do you ever encounter anyone who, basically manages up really well but kicks down?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've seen. The beauty of being in the military is, you start out, you see commanders and admirals and generals, and you just think they're omnipotent, they've done it, they've been there, and then you get kind of closer to them, and you realize they're as full of it as anybody and making it up as they go along, and I'm convinced that goes to the top. What I've found is the guys that I look for, or gals that I look for, because I work with both in very, very high-ranking positions, the folks that when you hear people talk of them, they'll have the respect of their subordinates or the folks underneath them. They'll have the respect of their seniors, and in there they will have at least, I would say, 10%. I used to tell my junior guys, I want to be about 90% liked and about 10% straight hated. I mean, I want 10% to think I am incompetent, arrogant, a jerk, and just too aggressive for the job. Because I feel like if you don't do that, you're not standing or holding the line for anything. I mean, if you please everyone, you're not doing the job in a leadership role. And so I had one commander that I worked for a long period of time. Everyone north of him on the chain of command thought he walked on water. Every single person that worked for him, if they had an opportunity to, you know, run him over in a dark alley, they would have done it. And that's bad juju. Like, you know, you squash everybody below you, but all the people senior to you think you're flowers and roses. It's very, very interesting to watch that. But I think 90-10 is about a good percentage. And I think I achieved that.
So when we talked last time, you were about a year out of active duty, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And this person here in the audience wants to know, so what's the transition been like from a very private person, had to keep a lot of things confidential, to a much more public life?
I think I've kind of seen it as a responsibility. I mean, I'm not the only voice of my, you know, community by any stretch. I hope I've been one of the good voices and one that's been disciplined and done it in the right way. The transition has been great. To be honest, I got to do everything I wanted to do. I got to go, face enemies and, you know, East and West Africa, Iraq, Afghanistan, Central and South America. I mean, there's not too many spots I haven't been fighting bad guys. And that's what I don't want to, you know, guys don't want war to launch. At the same time, when the call comes, we want the call. And I got to turn all those stones over and kind of experience, the furthest interaction extreme, I guess, you can have with another human being, which is trying to take each other's lives. And so, I have nothing that I didn't do in my time on active duty that I didn't want to do. So, I got to that executive level and realized I'd be staring at two computer screens and doing very much the same job for a long period of time. I greatly respect my buddies that have stayed, and a lot of good guys have. And I have moments where I wish I could be there to help, you know, guide and protect the boys and take care of them. But there are just a lot of new adventures. And so the transition's been great. I have buddies that are transitioning out of the military that are really wrestling with it. I've got a buddy that's a sniper that is one of the most talented human beings I have ever met. There is nothing he couldn't do and achieve. But he thinks because he's a sniper, the only thing in his next life is going to an FBI hostage rescue team, working a SWAT team. And I tell him, I say, you know, you're looking at it the wrong way. You're thinking of the tangible skills we take and how does that translate? What you are is somebody with unheard of discipline, a true understanding of rank structure and how a group of people works at a high level dynamic. You don't know how to punch a clock. You will never quit. You know how to work till the job's done. There is an organization on earth that isn't looking for you. And so I think if veterans can translate that, they'll find a home. And if you're in the room or listening and you run a company and you're not taking a real serious look at veterans as a hiring pool, you're missing some tremendous, tremendous talent. Because it's I get to speak at elite colleges and places like that every once in a while. I was talking at Harvard to some business students last year, and they're all getting ready to leave business school and they're going to go kill it in the world. And, you know, I told them, I said, hey, if you haven't thought about military service, I'll just tee it up. I mean, if you get hired by Goldman Sachs tomorrow, they're not going to put you in charge of anything important anytime soon. You'll get there, but it ain't going to happen day one. The day you graduate from officer school, you're in charge of about 10, 15, 12, four people's lives. That's what we put you in charge of. And that's a pretty special place to cut your teeth. And so for me, it was, you know, it was a dream come true. And so that's, I don't now remember the question, but here we are.
Yeah. Well, this actually kind of coming at another tack. One of the sections that you do have in the book is how to kill right. Since trying to kill the people who are trying to kill you is part of the job. So how do you kill right?
So I wrote an entire chapter on killing, and it probably became one of my favorite chapters in the book. I didn't set out or think to write that chapter. It just kind of came up in conversations with Ellis, my co-writer, who's become a good friend and a mentor and a great thinker. We think very differently about the world, which is just a great thing. He's whip smart, and we talk a lot about this. And the killing part of this job is a very, very interesting part of this job. And I think there are a lot of levels to it. I think our culture has been so desensitized to the actual reality of it because of movies and songs and video games and things like that, where when we do it out on the actual battlefield, it's real. And I think there are some units and some parts of the U.S. military, I think, that try and kind of dehumanize the enemy and make it something other than a person. And that's probably okay. That's probably their ability to get a mass number of people to shoot online and go kill bad guys. Our guys don't experience it that way. We're much more, I've been in a gunfight with somebody from me to you, which is a very different place to be fighting from. And so I was very aware that I was killing my own species, that this was someone's husband, dad, brother, had kids, and all the things that go along with that, and that's not a small thing. I feel lucky in my experience that I don't think I ever leveled my sights on a target that wasn't trying to kill me or one of my teammates and wasn't an enemy combatant. I never pulled the trigger and had regrets about the fact that it was a bad kill. We can argue whether the war was right or that fight was right, but I never personally had that experience, which is a gift. I have buddies that's not the case, that probably shot when they shouldn't have shot or shot, made a bad choice, and that's the price and cost of the fight. But I do think I'm a hunter also. I mean, I've become a hunter, you know, of big game animals and things like that in my next life. I don't do it for trophy. I do it for the experience of being in harsh locations and actually putting food on the table, which I really enjoy. I can put better food on the table than Whole Foods on my own. But the thing that's interesting about hunters is I think the anti-hunter crowd, I think, thinks hunters don't care about the quarry they pursue, and it's absolutely the opposite. I don't know a group of people that cares more about that which they seek to kill than hunters, because we want there to be more of those animals. We want to be able to hunt for the rest of our lives, and so the cycles and rhythms and the habitat and the things that those animals require, we're more vested in taking care of than anybody from a non-hunting group. It's a real interesting thing. And so I equated a little bit to that. I had tremendous respect for anybody I fought on the battlefield, and I feel, you know, very lucky to have come out of it the way I came out of it. But I think having reverence for that and taking it seriously is hugely, hugely important. And to do less than that, I think you'd also kind of maybe disrupt the gods of war, and they're pretty pitiless. So I took it serious.
So the name of your book is Worth Dying For, and you talk about some of the things that are worth dying for. So where would you start?
I think everybody has a sense of the obvious, right? I think most people would say, of course, I would die for my family. I would die for my loved ones. Maybe there's something I'd be willing to protect. And I think my call in that book is that there are bigger things than just that. That certainly is on my list. I mean, anybody comes to my house with, bad intentions or is looking to do harm to my family will have made an egregious mistake. But I also have seen in this experience these other parts of the world. And what this country is just, it's otherworldly what we enjoy. And so for me, it was 100% worth going out to fight for that, and then to go put, you know, my hat in the ring and into that level of service. And so there's just a tremendous amount of the world that's ugly. I mean, I know this is from, I'm born American. I mean, people talk about, you know, we have Irish blood in my family. I don't think about that. I'm a pure born, bred American. So my entire life has been wrapped around freedom. And I believe that's something that very, very few people enjoy. I don't even think most of our allies experience it the way we experience it. 2 days ago, I was at a speaking event, and I got to spend time with Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of England. And we had just an amazing conversation on the fact that he was kind of saying to me and to us that, you know, we're watching your election. We're thinking about where America's going and what's happening. And you cannot believe how important that is to the free world, how you guys can't go isolationist. You cannot go away from your responsibility to do this in the world. And he said it in a very eloquent way, better than I'll be able to repeat it, but that he thinks he just thought it's our destiny to be that group of people in the world. And so to have had a part in that, I just feel humbled to have been a part of it and to have experienced it. And it's something why service and maybe future political service appeals is to continue that tradition and hopefully continue to serve. But I think thinking about what's worth dying for or what's worth fighting for, I wrestle with worth dying for and worth fighting for. Fighting sounded better because I prefer to do that than what I settled on. I think dying for just became more intense, so I think we went with that. But, you know, I think knowing what is worth fighting for and what's worth struggling for is important. And I talk a lot about heroism in the book, and I think there's this ideal of heroism that everyone in uniform is a hero. I won't begrudge anybody that sentiment. None of us in uniform feel that way. None of us feel that way. I've met Medal of Honor winners in every everybody in between, nobody feels like a hero, and it's kind of an awkward thing to get labeled on because I look at my mom and working hard to, help raise my brother, and somebody that's just working their tail off every day and probably a terrible job to contribute and put food on the table for their family, and the folks that show up and do their jobs and work hard and kind of are part of this thing without complaining about it, those are heroes to me. And you know, if some kid at Whole Foods sees, you know, the little old lady trying to get to the back of her car and helps her to the car with her groceries, that's a hero right then, you know. And I think the opportunities exist every day to be a hero. And you know, that's something I want to teach to my kiddos and to those around me, that those opportunities exist daily, not in these big moments that you can't control in the battlefield. Everybody of mine that got some spectacular award was like, oh, I can't believe it happened. I made it out of there. I got lucky. Every single one of them. So I think thinking about what's worth fighting for and dying for is important, and it's something I hope people do.
So here's someone in the audience wants to know a question that's near and dear to folks in the Bay Area. What do you think of the Colin Kaepernick controversy?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I have real mixed feelings. I didn't kind of go to social media on that one because there's some things that I like thinking about longer than just an immediate reaction. And I saw very polar reactions from folks in the military. My initial reaction was knock yourself out. Again, something we're fighting for. You have every right to do that. And that's 100% something that we hold dear, that you have the right to exercise that level of protest. I'm not sure if he's figured out what he's protesting. I mean, my sense is I don't think the plight of Black America has really been burdened on Colin Kaepernick. This doesn't strike me as his plight. But if he has something to do about it and he has some way to make something better, knock yourself out. You want to take your $19 million a year salary and put that for good and put that into some youth program that will bring up some level of folks that might not have an opportunity, I'm all for it. I think to see him kneeling while, and the others that have fallen with him when, you know, a bunch of service members are standing there with the flag is tough, but I'm almost split down the middle. You know, I think he has every right to do it, and I'm honored that we've been part of that. And, you know, I don't think I'd want to go get a beer with him.
So here's someone in the audience. They want to know, do you worry about ISIS with their capabilities getting into the United States?
Yeah, you know, ISIS is just a new name, right? There is nothing new under the sun with this ideology and the way they think about the world. So ISIS is a new version of the same group that we were fighting in multiple locations around Africa, Middle East, Afghanistan, these different spots. It's the same animal. We have missed a huge opportunity to fight them early on. You know, it's like you have a stomach ache. You go in to see a doctor. The doctor's like, that's cancer. We got it early. Let's take care of it. We've let this group metastasize a little bit, and now they've got a good foothold in a lot of places and are creating a tremendous amount of problems. I mean, I'm not somebody that would go quick to war. We talked about this a little bit before, that if I was in charge tomorrow, I think in my inaugural address, I can't remember if I said this last time we were talking about it, because I've thought about this for a long time, I would be speaking to two groups. I'd be speaking to the public here and Americans. I'd be speaking to our enemies at the same time. And I think being a SEAL, you'd probably say, well, this guy's going to be quick to war. And I would be the slowest to war I could possibly be. I mean, I would exhaust every single measure, diplomacy, negotiations. I'd let the UN have their shot. And we do everything we could to avoid war. If that failed and it's time to fight, and obviously I believe there are things worth fighting for, God help you if you're the bad guy, because I would wipe you off the face of the earth. There would be no lawyers on the battlefield. It would be like the worst parts of the Old Testament. And then when it was done, I would extend an olive branch and we'd give you another shot. I believe this current enemy is ripe for that type of fight. I think a very small few have absolutely hijacked an entire group of people, particularly the young, in such a way that it has just overshadowed the whole. And so I think you go crush ISIS. And you know, we have special forces that are designed to go specifically target in multiple different locations bad guys. I mean, we can hunt bad guys anywhere on earth. And you know, all these guys are tough as can be on YouTube. You know, they got some guy in an orange jumpsuit on YouTube someplace in sub-Saharan Africa, and they look pretty tough. YouTube videos of ISIS fighters captured. Every one of them's crying. Every one of them is, like, denouncing the fact that they were doing something wrong. I don't believe they're a warrior people the way we're a warrior people. I think the warrior spirit that exists here is unique in the world. And I think there are bloodlines, and I think an American bloodline is one of them, that is just bred to fight in a different way. So if you agitate our guys and put us into that fight, there's nobody we won't beat in a fist fight. You just need to get the, it sounds tough, but you got to get the rules of engagement and go all out to be able to win that fight and get out of there. And I think there is an undercurrent. We were talking about this with Tony Blair. He was saying how His Holiness the Pope has like 9.8 million followers on Twitter right now. And like the 12th ranking cleric in the Middle East that's an extremist has like 24 million followers. And so this message is going out, and kids in Palestine and in Nigeria are being indoctrinated into this system that they would never be able to break out of, because at a young age, when you're easily influenced, you're going to think going to kill Israelis and Westerners is the thing to do and what it should be. And there's no way to get that poison out. But I think there's this undercurrent of young folks that might want to turn the tide, and I think we need to help facilitate that. You cannot do that when you're when you have the leading force being the extremist. So, but it's very challenging. It's very, very challenging.
Well, Work Denver, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For a fascinating and lively discussion.
I'm going to say one more thing.
Please.
Before we close. So there's only two reasons SEALs are ever, I get emotional when I talk about this, but there's only two reasons SEALs will ever be off base in uniform. One is to attend a wedding, which is an awesome reason to be off base and to celebrate that moment with your teammate and his bride and how they're going to become a stronger bond and make our team stronger. And the other is to attend a funeral. And I stopped counting funerals at 35. 35 is when I stopped counting. I've been to at least double that many. But I've never been in uniform and been off base and not have people almost bruise my back thanking me for my service. I mean, it's just an insane time to be a warrior in this country, because the support has been otherworldly, you know, and there's people I know for a fact, there's people in this audience that came back from a different war to a different reception, which I can't wrap my head around. But it occurs to me that every time I get a chance to speak to folks, I get to return the favor. So I mean this very, very sincerely. I thank everybody here for your service. I thank you for giving us something to go fight for, because I feel this country is still an experiment. And it's very, very fragile. But if there weren't people like you, there'd be zero reason for me to kiss my bride and my littles goodbye and my buddies and I go chase our enemies. But we do so happily because it's worth fighting for. So I thank all of you so much. Yep. Thank you. Thank you.
So we hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. And again, we'd like to thank Rourke Denver, author of Worth Dying For, A Navy SEAL's Call to a Nation. We'd like to thank our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio and the web. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.